This is Canada Reads American Style, featuring two friends who love Canada Reads and Canadian literature. Welcome our host Rebecca from Michigan and Tara from Ontario.
Welcome to the podcast, Canada Reads American Style. Tara with you today. Rebecca is not joining me. It's just me, but I do have a very special guest joining me today. It's you, because we have our cameras on, even though you can't see us right now. Okay, I'm going to introduce my guest. Vince R. Dietrich is the author of the Tony Vicker series, which includes The Liquor Vicker, The Vicker's Knickers, and The Vicker Vortex. He is also, and this is how he came onto to my scene, oh, like 30 years ago, the drummer and manager of the, I'm going to say it, the iconic Canadian band, Spirit of the West. He has circled the world, earned more than a dozen gold and platinum albums, and been enshrined in several halls of fame. Vince currently lives on Vancouver Island, and I am so excited to welcome you to the podcast, Vince.
Thank you for having me. I'm very pleased to be doing this, and I look forward to your many questions. You can hold my feet to the fire, I'm sure.
Well, I hope I don't disappoint you.
Oh, we'll see.
I like how you're leaving that open. Like, I may disappoint you.
No, I may disappoint you, but please go ahead.
Okay. So I'm going to start before we get into the books. Let's start because I did say you were a musician. You were with Spirit of the West. How did you make the transition from musician to writer?
Well, I've always been interested in writing, and I was writing all through, since elementary school, I was writing little stories, and, you know, I told myself one day I would write a book, and it never really happened because I was my whole life on the road traveling, but I did keep notes, and I wrote poetry, ghastly poetry of a young man looking for his future. Some of it is really bad, but I always was writing, and I was, for example, in high school and junior high school, I was always the editor of the school paper, and I enjoyed that kind of stuff. So it was music and writing. They were both very large in my mind, but music took the front seat. And then I played for 10 million years, and around about the age of 53, Spirit of the West finally retired. Unfortunately, we had to shut down because Johnny, our lead singer, was so sick, and he subsequently passed away from early onset Alzheimer's disease. And I was really sick. I had to get a new aftermarket kidney. Jeffrey Kelly from the band was very sick. He has Crohn's disease. So we barely made it to the finish line. And after that, after the initial surgery on my part, I needed to do something creative because having done something in the arts my whole life, I needed an outlet. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to write a book, now's the time to write a book. So I launched into it and just started riffing and writing and riffing and nipping and tucking and moving things around, and eventually it was a book, and then I started shopping it around, and that was a slightly difficult aspect because I knew no one in the industry, and I didn't know how what the proper method of shopping was. So I just used the musician method, which was you find the president and you call him, you know. Whoever the boss is, you call him and you say, "Do you know who I think I am?" And it usually terrified them, but because I think authors are generally kind of mousy and polite. Not me. I just blast the door open and do a song and dance. And I managed to find a deal with Dundurn Press of Toronto. And they've been very good to me.
Okay, so that's a great segue. Tell us about Tony Vicker and the series, the trilogy.
The story is centered around Tony Vicker, who is a failed musician. He's one of those people, I've known thousands of them, where they kind of have the same hairdo that they had in grade 11, and they just stayed with it in the same pants and the same T-shirt. And they're always playing some Led Zeppelin song or some Pink Floyd song on their electric guitar. And they figure if they buy a new, more expensive electric guitar, their playing is going to improve. And just, he's a wannabe, a dreamer with delusions of grandeur. And he can't let go of the dream. He lives in a tiny, tiny little town on Vancouver Island, a fictional town called Tai Lagoon. And he's always got some kind of band going. And he has to have a part-time job to keep that dream alive. And the part-time jobs are short-lived and not very glamorous. And he's just basically an overgrown teenager.
He is one of the characters. I can't remember which book it was in, but one of the other characters described him as absurd but compelling. And I thought that was like a perfect description of him and the series, actually, because it's quite funny. I giggled out loud quite often in all three books when I was reading it, and that does not happen often. But then you would have these little moments of like heart. I'm just going to call them little moments of heart that would just, they were unexpected, but just kind of seemed to fit in perfectly with the world that you had created.
Well, the world that I created was one that I had lived in for a long time, because a touring musician, especially in the lower ranks in Canada, it's just like you're living amongst cartoon characters. And most of these guys, they just want to be the puffy-haired rock star, the Eddie Van Halen, whoever it is. That's what they dream. That's the world in which they want to be. And they have so many skills, and they have so much kindness and warmth, and they're lovely people, but they're just living in cloud cuckoo land. And I took note of this very early on, because I knew that I was going to become a very serious professional musician, and I studied toward that end. But these guys were just, well, I got some new pants, maybe that's going to be the ticket, you know. And they had no idea that they could be really good at whatever job they took on. Every job's a good job if you do it well. And some of these guys went on later in life after they finally gave up on music, and they had successful businesses or eventually went to university, got a degree, and now they're off doing something in biology or chemistry. But, you know, for the most part, they were oblivious to their own talents. And this Tony Vicker character is exactly that. He's the delusions of grandeur kind of blind him to the fact that he has very, very special talents, and they even veer into the paranormal. And he is very sensitive, although he has all the social skills of a bucket of manure falling from a great height.
I think we can't even discuss the book without mentioning, because it's not just Tony. You have created a whole community. Like, he finds, even though this is the community he's lived in, I think his whole life, right? The Tai Lagoon. Yeah. He really, throughout these books, finds his family. But the Tai Lagoon is populated by an eccentric cast of characters. Were you inspired by the people that you met during your career or in your life? Like, it's, I love them. And like, my favorite name might be Ross Poutine.
He's, yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah, I stumbled across that name early on in the writing process, and I remember leaping up from the chair in the living room and running back and typing it down and making a character description. I knew so many guys like that, and almost all of the characters are modeled along a person or multiple people who had certain characteristics. Sometimes I took a certain thread out of one or another, and I bundled them together to become a character, but they all had a purpose. You know, they all stand for something within the matrix of this town and its story. But Ross Poutine, right? He's his real name is McFaddish, Ross McFaddish, but he came from Montreal in 1972. He wanted to come out logging, and turned out it wasn't for him. He got hurt too often, but he just had abysmal hygiene. He always smelled like a goat. And so, you know, not only is he from Montreal where you can get poutine, but he, you know, he smells like a Rasputin. So, you know, the double entendre there, I thought was kind of a smirk. It was a smirk, and a nudge, you know. I enjoyed that.
So did you set out to write a humorous book when you started, or did it just
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. I had absolutely no intention of writing one of those meaningful book about those damn feelings. Too many feelings out there. I need escape. I really, in my entertainment, I need escape. And the stories that I have gathered are too impossible to believe for the average person. They would say, no, he's just made this all up completely. And yes, the book is made up. The plotting is made up. But very, very many of those situations are situations in which I was a victim or took part or I watched somebody else firsthand in those situations, those conversations, those scenarios. It's just really difficult to believe that people lived this way and believed these things and acted in these bizarre manners. So I had to make it as funny as possible in order for it to, you know, the spoonful of sugar to make that go down.
But there are still a lot of feelings in the book.
Sure.
Yeah.
The clown is always crying, you know?
Yeah. And it's not easy to write humor. Like, I think people think that because something is funny, that it's easy. Mm. But it's not easy to write, make someone laugh on the page.
It's very, very difficult to write something that is that has the voice of a human that can be understood as humorous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you have to go so deeply into it, and you have to realize that telling a joke face-to-face or telling a story face-to-face uses completely different muscles than writing it down and having the reader conjure the scenario and the look of the person doing the incredibly odd thing. You have to add in a lot of information, a lot of background data, and paint a lot of interiors, you know?
Mm-hmm.
To set it up so that it is really funny or really dark or really absurd. And I mean, there's in book two, there is a scenario where Tony Vicker and his band, the Hospital Fish, they're playing at the Vicker's Knickers, and they've set up like they're playing at a hockey rink, but they're playing in a tiny little pub. And the drummer has a 19 million piece drum kit, which is what I once had when I was a kid. And the lighting technician has set up a smoke machine that makes the whole bar smudge. It's just, it's a ridiculous situation. That happened to me. Then the pilot light in this garden fogger, which was what it was, a garden fogger, it went out and it just started spraying oil on me. Instead of smoke, it was oil. And I was slathered in oil. It looked like somebody had just poured Mazola all over me. And I was trying to hold on to drumsticks covered in oil. And I was going, guys, stop. I got to wipe this off. And they wouldn't stop because we were playing in Calgary and that's like a damn concert, you know? You know, so seriously, these kids would spend, oh my God, we'd spend thousands of dollars on equipment that we didn't know how to use and put on these concerts in these stupid bars where a fist fight was just as likely to break out as anything else. Just absurd. And I'm standing there in my costume, my spandex covered in oil. And I thought, I got to remember that one and throw it in a book someday. And so I did. I adapted it into that tale.
Did you say you were in spandex?
Of course we wore spandex at one point. This was way back before I'd even moved to Vancouver and become a member of Spirit of the West.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Everybody had spandex and poofy poodle hair. And we weren't going to take it.
Okay, now I have a great image in my head. So thank you.
Yeah.
That was like a favorite scene. Did you have a favorite scene to write in these books or a favorite character?
No, I tried to I tried to make them all equal. I put as much love into each one because I began each one with one person in mind as the source of the character, and then I added in other characteristics as time came along. And so each one of them is based on somebody that I knew and liked, or knew and appreciated, or knew and disliked strongly. Yeah. You know, there's one in the first book where he punches out the one guy, Randy Johnson, which I thought was a hilarious name. We all have a Randy Johnson. I particularly disliked that character. And, yeah. So I had made sure that Vicar put him down with prejudice, but most of them are people that I knew. Threads of them contain people that I knew, and I just recalled a lot of situations from my youth, and I turned them into this narrative. And so I liked them all, and I knew that they all had value depending on where, what they needed to say and when they needed to say it.
Nice. What was the most challenging aspect of writing?
Making it exciting, but not too exciting. Making it heartfelt, but not too heartfelt. Finding balance, you know?
Yeah.
Pacing, balance, and plotting, you know? Because I'm a musician, so I think of writing more like a song. You know, I start with a riff, and I start ad-libbing from there. And then I very, very usually, like, it's not at all uncommon for me to take a chapter from two-thirds of the way through the book and plop it early on, make a few changes. And so I'm changing the shape and the timeline of the book constantly. And it becomes exhausting after a while. I've sort of described it to other people as trying to make a bed with one arm. You know, you're always running from corner to corner, giving a tug here and a tug there and flattening with your hand and then tug over there.
Yeah.
It's a lot of persnickety detail work. And, you know, persnickety detail I can do to an extent, but then eventually I go, and I have to shut it down for the day.
Yeah, you have to let it go.
Yeah.
When you talked about the balance of finding, like, the heart or the feelings with the humor, one of my favorite moments, because you mentioned Tony's band Hospital Fish, and he goes through all the names of all of his bands and how he gets through them, and they're hilarious.
Yeah.
And then when we first hear of Hospital Fish, and I don't know if it was that same book or later in the book, he tells, I believe it was Jackie, his girlfriend, why the name Hospital Fish.
Exactly.
And it's just, it was a beautiful moment. And it was like this perfect little insight into Tony. Like, his character just, he's a full-blown character, but that just gave him another dimension.
It opened up a dark door in his head.
Yeah.
And you could suddenly you could taste in your mouth that tang of self-torture, mm-hmm. the torture that he was putting himself through, you know, to name the band after your mother's final meal.
You know?
It's kind of gross and sad. It was really sad. And
it was really sad.
I knew a lot of guys. I was one of those guys. The sadness just cloaked around us because we were out there doing a silly thing for people who didn't care about us, and we didn't know what our futures were going to be. There's a lot of depression amongst those guys. A lot of, and they'd never show it because they were always yee-hawing and smoking pot and drinking mm-hmm. beer. But a lot of guys were very depressed. I was definitely one of them. I was like, oh, how do I get out of this to the next level? Because it's a hard scrabble. Climb. And eventually I had to take a lot of steps to move in the correct direction. But the Hospital Fish name reminded me very much of my own mother's death and just how barren you feel when you realize you could have been there, but you're off playing some stupid song, not very well, to somebody who doesn't give a damn in some prairie town in the middle of the winter, and you go, ugh, it's like a gulag with costumes.
Yeah. I loved that part. I really, I did. I started off the book, so I've read all three books, and I loved Tony's progression from when we are first introduced to him. Yeah. When we first are introduced at the beginning of the first book, he is playing, and he is in a Elvis Presley costume, I believe, right? And
Yeah, he's doing an Elvis imitation. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's at his very lowest ebb in life. We find him. Yeah. And I worried about that because I thought, geez, I don't know if anybody's going to like this character and even read the rest of the book, because I want to start him at the very basement, laying in the sludge of the muddy septic box of life, you know?
Literally, yes.
Yeah.
Although from that moment, that's when he met Jackie.
Exactly. And that's always how it happens in real life, too. Just when you hit your worst moment, there's some glimmer, and if you can just get your finger on it, that's the way out. That's the way out. So he realizes later on throughout the books that she is the catalyst to his improvement. And he starts to become more and more comfortable with that. He's a little nervous that he may not be enough for her because he's a little older. He doesn't have as many credits to his CV, shall we say. He's not achieved much in life, but he knows this girl is like, wow, she's going places. So he wants to be with her, and he tries his best in his bumbling sort of ham-handed way.
And she is quite the character too. Like she is a strong woman. Like I really appreciated her presence in the book.
Yeah. I have a bunch of female friends who are very independent, very smart, very self-driven, and, you know, but great senses of humor. Mm-hmm. They seem to be able to roll with the punches. They can get in the dirt with the boys and fix a trailer hitch and weld and do all those things. But they're also women, and they can do wonderfully feminine things with such natural charm and comfort, which, you know, men just struggle. You know, even the most broadly open man just can't do women things like a woman can.
Now that we're talking about the female characters, I have to ask then, I'm drawing a blank for her name, but in the three books, we have like our I'm going to call her our bad character that carries.
Or Serena.
Through. Yes, Serena.
Yeah.
What inspired Serena?
Well, I needed a bad guy.
Yeah.
No, it's a combination of every fear you have as a young man, you know, when you see somebody who is really appealing and then they turn out to be nightmarish people. I just took that to the absolute nth degree. And there were some occasions in my life where things, vaguely along that line happened with various people. And I just amplified it to the maximum. Yeah. Tried to make her but I wanted to make sure that she wasn't a two-dimensional cutout and just, you know, she's bad news. No, yeah. She's so much more than that. She was troubled and abandoned and neglected. And
yeah.
Through the years, I met many, many young women like that. It's very much a tragedy. It's a scourge, actually. It's just way too common.
And then we have now the bad guys that I loved to hate, which were the American media that came up.
Richard X. Dick.
Yeah, yeah.
And his cameraman, Handlanger.
Yeah.
And for anybody who's interested, Handlanger is actually German for minion.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So his minion was named Minion. I thought that would be kind of fun for some of my German friends. And but he just seemed like a perfect slime ball. And once again, I tried to just demonstrate that he was not just a natural born slime ball, but he had, you know, he was kind of slimy by nature. He's willing to go a long way to get his story. But, you know, he had been put into a situation that was really, really unsavory. And so now he's trying to fight his way out of it. And he's very unhappy to be in Tai Lagoon, so far from Hollywood, where he has to fight and scratch to stay on top. And I kind of, to a certain degree, I empathize, because you can get, especially in the music business, you can get cranky about being sent off into the boondocks where you want to just stay on target, you know. But this guy was extra bad.
He was. I was not upset to see him get his comeuppance. Really?
Well, I had to soften my ending. My editor recommended that I soften it a bit because I got a little bit too much Alberta on him.
I can understand why. But yeah. People, you have to read the book to understand why and enjoy his comeuppance.
Yeah, he definitely, he got it good.
Yeah.
We end up sending him back to Hollywood without any teeth.
That's true. And you softened it. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now, is there going to be any more Tony Vicker? Is the series done?
It's paused temporarily for sure. I have just completed my contract for 3 books.
Yeah.
But I'm in the middle of trying to get a deal to turn this into a television series.
Oh, yes.
So, in fact, there was just more action today towards that. So I'm hoping to be able to make a big announcement within the next few months that we've got something formally signed and people on board to do this. And that's the natural next step because I wrote book one specifically with a very visual, punchy tone so that it would leap off the page to somebody from television and movies.
I can see that happening. My fingers are crossed for you then because it's very visual, the whole book. Like I have it pictured in my head. I have characters pictured in my head because they're so well described. And it's such an eccentric community that I think it would make it perfect. I would love to see it.
Well, I think it could be very successful.
Yeah.
The problem is that we have to get a bunch of people, a bunch of good things have to happen quickly in a row. And then, boom, we'll be off and running. But until then, I just have to speak in these terms of, well, we're hoping to, and gee, it might. But it takes one major person to say, yeah, I'm on board, and then, boom, we're away.
Awesome.
And then that's going to be another several years of my life. And I'm certain if that happens, there will be sufficient demand for books 4, 5, 6.
Amazing.
It just seems normal to me that that would be the case. Just
good.
And maybe more after that. I just want to make sure that I don't drain the tank too badly. And I have fresh ideas and new angles and new locations and stuff because you want to be able to get into a franchise. You want to build a franchise of your own, but you don't want it to turn into Nancy Drew. So it's got to be fresh and punchy, and people have high expectations of the spicy humor. And if you just start recycling jokes or anything like that, it's not good.
Well, my fingers are crossed for you.
Well, that'll be my bottom line is if I feel my own writing getting stale, I'm just going to say that's got to be it.
Yeah. Okay. I like to end off each interview too. I love knowing what you're reading.
I just finished rereading for about the 10th time the book Space by James Michener.
Okay.
I was just about to start. I don't know. I'm on one of these astronautic things again. I'm getting all hyped up about Jeremy Hansen going to the moon next year. So
nice.
I'm just hyping up on my old books. I think I'm about to read Lost Moon by James Lovell.
Okay.
The Apollo 13 commander.
Yeah, I'm seeing a theme.
Yeah, there's a theme. And he turned 96 the other day, so I was thinking about him.
Yeah.
And what else was I about? And I was about to read one of my volumes of the Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire.
Ah,
so that I can learn how to write words that nobody can untangle. That very old writing like that can be very slow going. But it's beautiful. It's very beautiful.
Nice. That's amazing. Well, thank you, Vince, so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me questions that are different than the normal question.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Most people don't ask about the other characters. They just want to know about Tony Vicker. And
yeah.
And this is very pleasant to talk about some of them. Like we didn't touch on Beaner Weens or Antenna or any of the other oddly named characters.
There's so many though. That's the thing. I wanted to. I also have a list. I had Mary Crabtree because I loved her as well. And then there was the chief who was like essentially the bouncer. So I loved him. So here we are. So I've said goodbye to you, and yet here I still am going about it. But yeah, the characters.
Did you catch the little the joke in Chief Wheat? His name is Hank, right? Hank Wheat.
Yeah.
Can you unravel what that might be a play on? Hank Wheat?
No, I'm terrible at these things, Vince.
Hank is short for Henry.
Yes.
And Wheat is French for eight. Henry the Eighth. So he looks like Henry the Eighth.
Yes,
isn't that a silly, hidden little bit Easter egg?
I know. I love Easter eggs, though, even when I don't get them, apparently.
Well, that one's obscure and deliberately so.
Well, thank you for telling me.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay, thank you very much, Vince.
Okay, cheers.
Thank you for joining us on our bookish journey. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing Canada Reads American Style wherever you listen. You can connect with the podcast and Rebecca on Instagram at Canada Reads American Style and with Tara at On A Branch Reads. Until next time, keep reading.